From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Big Oil, Vladimir Putin, and Transactional Diplomacy. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. Donald Trump's choice to be Secretary of State is Rex Tillerson, who's never had a job outside the oil giant ExxonMobil, where he's the longtime CEO. He and Vladimir Putin agreed to a multi-billion-dollar oil drilling deal, now subject to sanctions over Ukraine and Crimea. Sanctions Tillerson has opposed. Some key Republicans are already grumbling about Tillerson's ties to Russia and his lack of diplomatic experience, raising questions about Senate confirmation. We'll hear more about Tillerson and Trump's concept of foreign policy as a process of making deals. On our talking point later, a reported ceasefire may save many thousands of civilian lives in Aleppo. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. After world leaders and aid agencies appealed for saving thousands of lives, Syrian rebels confirm that a ceasefire has been reached with Russia to allow evacuation of eastern Aleppo. That's our talking point later in today's program. First, this news update. As a Republican candidate for president, former Texas Governor Rick Perry once called Donald Trump a cancer on conservatism. He also campaigned to abolish the Department of Energy. Now Trump has chosen Perry to run that very department as Secretary of Energy. Rob Barnett is Senior Energy Policy Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Is this kind of a surprise?
I would think not. The cabinet picks serve at the discretion of the president, and whether you look at Rick Perry for Department of Energy or Scott Pruitt at EPA, you essentially have ended up with agency critics running many of the departments that they're tasked with running.
But, of course, Perry was also a Trump critic.
Politics is an interesting game, isn't it? You know, Rick Perry is most likely going to fit the mold, in our view, with how President-elect Trump and the Republicans are thinking about the Department of Energy. And, you know, if they have their way, and there's always going to be politics about how you get what you want, but they want to divert focus away from renewables and more towards fossil fuel. And there's a lot of discussion about placing emphasis on nuclear power, too.
Can't help but stop for a moment and remind our listeners that in a debate at one point when Rick Perry was asked which three departments he wanted to abolish, energy was the one he forgot. He had that oops moment, and that was pretty much the end of his presidential campaign. So what does the Secretary of Energy actually do?
Good question. It is somewhat of a misnomer. In fact, a big portion of the Department of Energy's resources and time actually go towards maintenance of the nuclear weapons arsenal for the United States. The remaining portion of the budget for the Department of Energy is focused on very basic research questions. So the Department of Energy runs our national lab system here in the United States. It's basically a primary research agency. So the U.S. energy policy in some ways is set much more by the Environmental Protection Agency than the Department of Energy.
Back to the Department of Energy, though, with regard to the nuclear energy arsenal, what's the state of that at the moment? And why did Rick Perry ever explain why he wanted to see the end of the agency?
Well, I think that the there has been some misconceptions about what the agency does. And I think that a lot of the criticism of the agency by Rick Perry and others was more directed at the energy policy of President Barack Obama than part of the core fundamental mission of the Department of Energy, which, again, relates to national security interests. I don't think there are many folks in the Republican Party or the other side of the aisle that want to see the United States make a big change in how it approaches nuclear weapon security.
You mentioned the National Lab System, and recent secretaries of energy have been physicists, Ernest Moniz and Stephen Chu were both physicists. Obviously, Rick Perry isn't. What about that part of the agency? And what about the 74 questions that have been asked of people who work there by the Trump transition team? They seem to be worried that they're going to be targeted in some way as having tried to help Obama with his climate policies.
Well, we certainly have had some very credentialed secretaries of energy under President Barack Obama, but it has largely been a political appointee in the past. We had Bill Richardson, former governor of New Mexico under Bill Clinton, serve in that role. So it's not always that we have physicists heading up the Department of Energy. And as for the memo that you mentioned, I think it reflects a lot of the change that we're seeing in Washington. So President-elect Trump and his transition team are looking at how they want to put their imprint on the agencies. And as they've been thinking through that process, what you've seen is that, at least with the Department of Energy, they're looking to do things like boost the prospects for nuclear power, boost the prospects for oil, gas, coal development, and maybe have the agency play a lesser role in thinking about renewables such as wind and solar.
There is an extensive story in the Washington Post today to the effect that many scientists are worried about the Trump administration deleting climate change data, which goes back over history, of course, and is very massive in content. Is there any real risk of that, or is it stored in other places besides the government departments that the Trump administration might have jurisdiction over?
I'd certainly be very surprised if we saw historical data deleted or at risk in any way. There may be questions about whether we continue to collect certain time series or certain kinds of data, and whether we change the sort of priorities of the kinds of data that we're collecting. But generally, I would think of as historical data being quite safe. Certainly, it would be unprecedented to go back and try to erase the record on something.
All right. Once again, Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, former presidential candidate, former critic of Donald Trump, and man who said he wanted to abolish the Energy Department, now named as Secretary of Energy. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll be back in a moment to hear more from Rob Burnett and others about Donald Trump's choice to be Secretary of State. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Rex Tillerson is Donald Trump's choice to be Secretary of State. Since he grew up in Texas, Tillerson has never worked any place other than ExxonMobil, but he's the longtime head of that oil giant, one of the world's biggest corporations. Strikes against him include his lack of diplomatic experience and his close ties to Vladimir Putin's Russia. Shane Goldmacher is senior political reporter at Politico. Always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the connection to Vladimir Putin. What is it?
They do have some connections, mostly business. So he's been with ExxonMobil his entire career. And while head of ExxonMobil, he has struck deals on oil and energy with Russia, including in recent years. He's got ties to another Russian official who is on the U.S. sanctions list. And a couple of years ago, Vladimir Putin awarded him an order of friendship with the country. Now, all of this, of course, is as a business leader, not as America's top diplomat, but amid the accusations of Russian hacking and involvement in trying to sway the American election, is certainly raising questions among Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill.
We've seen pictures, of course, of Tillerson and Vladimir Putin smiling together, apparently as the order of friendship was being delivered. How important is that?
The Order of Friendship or the photograph?
No, the order of Friendship.
I think both could be important. I already saw an animated GIF on the internet of the handshake between Tillerson and Putin. I think that's an image that Democrats are going to be pretty happy to project. Look, I mean, people have said that there are not that many Americans who have a personal relationship with Vladimir Putin, and he is one of them. Tillerson is one of those folks. Now, the Trump folks see this as an advantage, that he already knows international players and he knows deals, and that, yes, he's worked with him because he needed the oil, because he runs one of the world's largest oil companies. It doesn't mean that they're actually friends. But these are questions that are going to come out. Again, you know, Tillerson does not have a large public profile. He certainly doesn't have a political profile. And this is almost certain to become one of the signature confirmation fights of the next month, month and a half.
Not just no political profile, but he sort of denied having a political profile. Last year, Tillerson was interviewed at the Economic Club of Washington by the club president, David Rubenstein. Here's how it went.
I take it you're not in town to interview for a government job, right? You're not. You wouldn't be a candidate to work in government?
Probably not qualified.
Okay.
But it's stunning to me how often people look at me and they say, well, you know, you just don't understand this place. And I've been coming to this place for 30 years, working with our government, trying to formulate good policies. So I do understand this place.
Not qualified, he said at first, but then, of course, explaining that he has been there long enough and been there often enough to understand it. Richard Cohn is a history professor emeritus at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's an expert on civilian-military relations. Good to have you on our program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What do you think about the qualifications of Mr. Tillerson to be Secretary of State?
Well, I think they're very limited. Mr. Tillerson's worked for one employer his entire life. He's been inside one sector of the economy, and he's been working with government, but to promote an oil company and profits for his shareholders. My worry is that when he's in the room with the president-elect and the national security team, it's a limited group of people. Several generals and two businessmen, only one of whom's ever run for anything, and it's only the presidency. And how much can they really represent a broad view of things, a lot of different experiences? My worry is that they don't know what they don't know, and they don't take into account many things that people with broader experience might have.
So you're taking a broad look, not just at Mr. Tillerson, but at the whole Trump team.
Well, the Secretary of State is an indispensable member of that team, and with the president, he's likely to be the only civilian in the room in a national security crisis. That's problematical and troubling. And furthermore, this is a team that has to make policy for the United States. Mr. Trump and Mr. Tillerson are basically transactional businessmen. This isn't just about making deals. This is about formulating policies that represent a very diverse nation with very many different kinds of interests. How well do each of them in their own business bubbles and backgrounds really understand the United States, its values, its norms, its historical experience, and its relationship with the outside world?
Before he is confirmed by the Senate, Mr. Tillerson will have to go through hearings at the Foreign Relations Committee. One of the members of that is John McCain, very senior member, obviously. That committee has the power to either send Tillerson's name to the Senate floor or not. John McCain is very concerned about those ties we heard about earlier to Vladimir Putin.
Anybody who's a friend of Vladimir Putin must disregard the fact that Vladimir Putin is a murderer, a thug, a KGB agent, whose airplanes, as we speak, have been targeting with precision weapons hospitals in Aleppo.
Shane Goldmacher, once again, back to you, senior political reporter at Politico. How much of that kind of concern are we hearing from members of the committee and others in Congress?
A fair amount, and from prominent Republicans. You just, you know, we listened to McCain, Lindsey Graham, who's closely aligned with McCain on most of these issues, has issued a statement today saying his ties to Russia are going to be front and center of any confirmation hearings. Marco Rubio has expressed some concerns. Rand Paul has expressed some concerns. This, frankly, I've heard is one of the reasons that the Trump folks wanted to get this nomination out there. By having him be officially nominated, typically you get a little bit more party discipline. Some of these folks might get back in line. That is not what McCain has done just yet, or Lindsey Graham. But he is certainly going to have an interesting confirmation process. Just to follow up on the earlier discussion, too, you know, again, he has relationships around the world, but he's had relationships as a businessman. So a big question is, you know, how do you go from negotiating on behalf of your shareholders, where those are your top people, to negotiating on behalf of the American people? This is a different perspective. It was good for his shareholders to strike an oil deal with Vladimir Putin. And that's the terms in which he's always dealt with these folks. Again, this has been his sole job for 40 years working for ExxonMobil. This is going to be a very, very different set of responsibilities.
The Senate is divided 58 Republicans to 42. You mentioned four potential Republican votes. 52-48. I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Wrote it down wrong. So that's enough to stop him.
Conceivably, it could be. But again, typically, there's been a fair amount of party discipline when it comes to selecting nominations. You have to disqualify the person. You know, but this is the kind of thing that, because he's the head of ExxonMobil, you're going to likely see fairly united Democratic opposition. They're going to see Democratic opposition on environmental grounds, on the fact that he's the head of an oil company, and on the ties to Russia. So you have multiple ways to go after him as far as Democrats are concerned. And Republicans, it's chiefly this issue about ties to Russia. And he is going to have some questions he's going to have to answer. Why did you accept this gift, an award from Vladimir Putin?
Aaron David Miller is with us. He's vice president at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. He's author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Spent more than 20 years at the State Department. He's been in both Democratic and Republican administrations, and he was a Middle East negotiator at one point. Good to have you, as always.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
How are you concerned, are you, about this idea of diplomacy as a transactional kind of engagement with other countries? Is it, in fact, comparable to what business heads do on behalf of their shareholders? Is that analogous to what the Secretary of State does for the people?
Well, it really depends on your definition of transaction. I would argue to you, the guests and the listeners, that in a world that cannot be transformed and from which the United States cannot withdraw, that is to say, no transformation, no extrication, that the only course for the U.S. to follow is indeed transactional diplomacy, drilling down on what your core interests are, not getting diverted by discretionary or other enterprises that are likely to be nation-encumbering that you can't resolve. I think that, frankly, Mr. Obama was a transactor. George H.W. Bush, for whom I worked, was a transactor. And in many respects, Bill Clinton as well. So transaction is not, I don't think, is the problem here. I think part of the problem is that you have a sharp and radical break with precedent, which seems to be one of the hallmarks of the President-elect's philosophy of the transition. I mean, only George Shultz, who worked for Bechtel from 1974 to 1982, the only Secretary of State in the modern period since the end of the Second World War to have significant private sector experience, and with Shultz, he was Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of Labor, and head of OMB before he became Secretary of State and before he worked for Bechtel. I think there is a concern in trying to separate and divide, you know, what is Exxon's. You know, it's not necessarily the case, as we know, that what's good for the GM is good for America and vice versa. But the success or failure of any Secretary of State, frankly, has less to do with the persona and background of the actual nominee and much more to do with two other factors, which in some respects are beyond that person's control. One is the relationship that a putative secretary has with the president of the United States. Will that president empower him at home and abroad? Will that president favor him as he seeks counsel from a variety of his advisors, in this case including perhaps family members? That's number one. And number two is the simple fact that if the world doesn't cooperate, if you don't have crises that are tractable and agreements to broker, I don't care what kind of negotiator you are, how much foreign policy experience you have, you're not going to get anywhere. You know, had there been no 1973 war, Henry Kissinger would not have been able to negotiate three disengagement agreements and pave the way for Sadat's trip to Jerusalem. Had there been no Gulf War, Jim Baker and Bush 41 would not have been able to put together the Madrid Peace Conference. So, you know, men, Marx wrote, writing in the 19th century, make history, but rarely as they please. And I think we have to really focus to a degree not just on the persona and the background and the qualifications. They are important. They are necessary, but they are not sufficient for the effectiveness of a consequential Secretary of State. At least that's my experience working for half a dozen of them.
All right. You mentioned George Shultz particularly. He, of course, was Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan. I want to go back to Richard Cohn at the University of North Carolina. What do you say to the idea that the only way you can do this is transactional, given the fact that you can't change the world? Does that make you feel any better about the people who are going to be in the room with Donald Trump?
It does not, because in these national security and foreign policy discussions, Mr. Tillerson is likely to be the only non-military person in the room, and he's got to represent in the making of policy and in the decision-making a broad perspective. He has to know a lot about a lot of things, not just about foreign countries. Got to know his own country. Got to know what the American people want and need. None of those people, other than Mr. Trump, will have run for office. They're used to being in hierarchical organizations where they order things done, and they can get things done. Certainly they have important experience. But in the formulation of policy and in how to deal with a problem, one wonders, for example, what Mr. Tillerson, beyond nuclear power, knows about nuclear weapons and nuclear doctrines, and those are kinds of things that are problematic, or about nuclear proliferation, or any of a dozen or several dozen other topics that he can advise the president and contribute to the conversation and to good decisions and to good policies.
I don't want to forget we still have Bob Barnett on the program. He is with Bloomberg Intelligence. And your energy policy analyst, we just heard mention of nuclear weapons. What about nuclear proliferation? And to what extent does the Secretary of State have to involve himself in that? And is this something that Mr. Tillerson might or might not be qualified to do?
Well, I think he's going to seek counsel from a number of sources. The Rex Tillerson has support of Condoleezza Rice, Mitch McConnell, even GE's Jeff Immelt said some nice comments about Rex Tillerson earlier today. So I envision that he would be the kind of person who will be taking lots of input. Presumably, there is no person out there who has a broad understanding when they come into a position like this of every aspect of policy that they'll be controlling. But I think it comes back down to this idea that Tillerson has a broad international experience that Trump's team seems to have gravitated toward. Only 19% of Exxon's 2015 oil production occurred in the United States. So 80-something percent was international. So in that perch, he had a broad exposure to countries all around the world. We've heard a lot about Russia, but many others as well.
All right. Rob Barnett, again, with Bloomberg Intelligence. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back, continue to talk about the Trump cabinet as it shapes up. On our reporter's notebook, a reported ceasefire may have saved thousands of lives in Aleppo. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now.
at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To The Point. We're talking about Rex Tillerson, the head of ExxonMobil, who's never worked at any other place in his professional life. Now Donald Trump's choice to be Secretary of State. He'll, of course, have to be confirmed by the Senate. We've already heard that there may be four Republicans who are looking askance at him with a 52-48 majority of Republicans. If all the Democrats vote against him and only three Republicans join them, he would not be confirmed. Shan Goldmacher, back to you at Politico. Don't want to necessarily predict that might happen, but what are some of the things they're going to be looking at? Particularly, we heard from Aaron David Miller that the man's own personal background may not be all that important, but people want to know about it. What do we know about him besides the fact that he spent all his life at ExxonMobil?
Well, one of the things is an outcome of having spent so much time at ExxonMobil, which is his incredible stock package that he has, which is heavily dependent on ExxonMobil stock, and how do you divest from that or not have your own mixed interest. He has somewhere, I think, on the order of more than $100 million in stock options. So that's one issue that I think is certainly going to come up. There are ways to deal with that, but that's one. And I think so much of this in terms of the Republican side of the ledger is going to come up around the issue of Russia and his view of the world. I think it says a lot about Donald Trump and his view of the world that among the finalists he was considering was Mitt Romney, who is called Russia America's biggest geopolitical foe and has been sort of a big hawk on Russia, and a guy who got an order of friendship from Putin. So Trump is very flexible when it comes to his foreign policy, and I do think that he sees this idea of deal-making with foreign states and heads of state as key to his job. So what role a Tillerson will play versus General Mattis as his defense secretary? Look, this is all fairly uncharted waters. We have, for the first time, a president-elect who is not a politician, hasn't held elected office, or served high up in the military. And so he's surrounding himself with some unorthodox picks, and I think Tillerson certainly falls into that camp.
Roger Stone, longtime GOP operative and sometimes associated with Donald Trump, sometimes not, has said that the reason that Romney was chosen at all was because Donald Trump wanted to let him swing in the wind, having called him a con and a fraud during the campaign. So there are all kinds of rumors and various reports about what's going on in the transition team. Rob Barnett, you have some more biography on Mr. Tillerson. Fill us in beyond that a little bit more on all the places, all the countries around the world where he has worked in as a result of ExxonMobil's vast global presence.
Yeah, that's right. He's worked in a number of countries, Yemen, Caspian Sea, Russia, and then in his current purpose, CEO, they have operations globally in numerous countries. Over 52% of the company's production occurs in Africa and Asia combined. So arguably, they have a very sophisticated view of what's going on around the world. In many ways, some have said it rivals the State Department itself in terms of thinking about political outcomes in different countries. Now, certainly they're thinking about it from a way to make money at ExxonMobil. But one of the issues is that he's engaged with quite regularly is the issue of climate change in his current perch. He said very favorable things about the Paris Climate Treaty, and he's talked even about a carbon tax as a way to sort of most cost-effectively reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So ironically, in some sense, he's got a more climate-friendly view than the pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency, which is certainly something that would be part of his discussion as Secretary of State.
So that's a surprise then. And again, we see in the Trump selections people who may in various ways contradict themselves or each other, just as Mr. Trump has come down on both sides of a number of issues himself.
That's right. Yes, he's it's complicated. In some sense, you could look at the issue of climate change as one that Exxon has some skin in the game on. So they are a seller, especially in the United States, of natural gas, which competes head-to-head with coal. And so if you have a carbon tax or if you have policies that aim at reducing emissions, natural gas has a much lower carbon footprint than coal-fired power. So if you had a policy sort of driving that market shift from coal to gas, that could actually be beneficial for ExxonMobil and other natural gas producers. So in some sense, to bring it back around, there is some tie-in to how ExxonMobil may be seeing the world when they talk about such things.
Richard Cohen, back to you at the University of North Carolina. You talked about the so many military people in the president's immediate decision-making group. Much has been said about ExxonMobil and the long-term deals that it has to engage in, because it takes so long to develop oil and to bring it out of the ground and ultimately make a profit on it, and it's so very expensive. And consequently, ExxonMobil has been favorably inclined toward governments that were very stable, which means that in some cases, we just heard a comparison to the State Department, in some cases, American aid to countries in Africa, for example, has been small by comparison to the amount of deal-making that ExxonMobil was doing with dictatorial and autocratic leaders of various countries. Does that concern you?
Well, it does, because for many decades, in fact, for most of our history, the purpose of American foreign policy is, first of all, American security, but second of all, the promotion of democracy and of liberty and of freedom, which in and of itself would, in American thinking, promote American security. And here you have two civilians in this group of foreign policy, national security people who don't have any experience in the broader aspects of American foreign policy. Mr. Tillerson, none in government representing the United States as a whole, and sometimes ignoring that in favor of Exxon's interests, and Mr. Trump. And so it really raises the question of what kind of a foreign policy is this administration going to promote. Mr. Trump has talked about making America great again and jobs at home. How much of foreign policy is he going to delegate the formulation of it and the goals of it to Mr. Tillerson? He may be a great negotiator and a great transactional president, but negotiating for what and what kinds of transactions? What does the United States want in the world under Mr. Trump and Mr. Tillerson other than jobs at home?
Aaron David Miller, back to you at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. You've worked for plenty of secretaries of state and presidents who wanted to promote democracy around the world. What about that? And does Donald Trump show any interest in it?
I mean, forgive me. Richard's a very smart guy, but we have, and I work for administrations who are only too happy in exchange for stability in the region to continue to support authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. Where do you want to start? Tunisia, Yemen, Egypt. I mean, we worked on the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations with Israeli acquiescence and basically turned a blind eye not only to Mr. Arafat's terror, but his authoritarian behavior at home. This is not just a question of a bunch of inexperienced folks, to use Jim Baker's expression, that rode in on a bale of hay yesterday. The Iraq War, and I admire George W. Bush greatly, was brought to you with a degree of with a collection of foreign policy advisors who are among the most experienced, knowledgeable, sensible, who reflected all of the virtues and the traits that that Richard has identified, that the president-elect and his company appear to lack. And look, I'm not running Mr. Trump is not my candidate. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. I work for Republicans and Democrats. But I think we also have to get a grip here. We're going to find out soon enough, once Mr. Trump inherits the cruel realities of actually governing, whether or not both the process of his campaign, the substance of his campaign, the style of his campaign can be reconciled with the realities that he's going to confront. Now, maybe they can't, and all of our worst fears will be borne out. And I worry greatly about the future of the Republic in this regard. But I think we also have to step back and take a deep breath. I mean, could Rex Tillerson become an effective Secretary of State? I think the answer is if Trump empowers him, if Mr. Trump has a sensible approach to America's interests in the world, and if the world cooperates, the answer is maybe.
So, Richard Cohn, maybe is the word we just heard. I'm interested in your response to that.
Well, my response would be that this ambivalence in American foreign policy between the promotion of democracy, freedom, and liberty, and national self-interest and national security goes back centuries in the United States. And it's the resolution of these conflicts and these ambiguities that has marked good foreign policy and success.
But what about the history we just heard about, of the history of supporting dictator after dictator in so many parts of the world?
Well, I'd ask Mr. Miller, also a very smart fellow and a very experienced fellow, how well has it turned out for us in the Middle East? How well has it turned out for us in various parts of the country? If you can't resolve these, no matter what kind of experience and what kind of intelligence and how much you listen to good advisors that you have, as he himself said in his earlier comments, sometimes the world doesn't cooperate, and sometimes there are unanticipated consequences that you have to be prepared to deal with, and to deal with a certain internal guiding light as to what it is you seek in your relationships with the world.
Well, I think you've both said that, that things are liable to change unexpectedly. Aaron David Miller, is the lesson here that, in some sense, the more things change as far as American policy is concerned, the more they stay the same?
Well, I think if you looked, with some exceptions, at the arc and the trajectory, there's more continuity in our basic policy, the contours and the parameters of our basic policies, than there is fundamental or profound change. I mean, what happened in Iraq was idiosyncratic. It was idiosyncratic because it was a response, as I mentioned earlier, to an external event which was traumatic and had never occurred before. So we end up fundamentally changing and course correcting largely in response to world events, not as a consequence of internal shifts that somehow fundamentally has American foreign policy lurching from pole to pole. And on one final point, Warren, on the issue of values and interests, John McCain, who I like and respect, says our values are our interests. And it's a very compelling point that he raises. The problem is, if you look at American foreign policy under the last half dozen administrations, and I suspect it'll be the same with Mr. Trump, our values, our interests, and our policies are never quite in harmony. We invade Iraq, but not Syria. We support an Arab Spring in Egypt, but not in Saudi Arabia. I mean, anomaly, contradiction, inconsistency, and hypocrisy are all part of the job descriptions of the great power. It would be nice if we could get it right, frankly. And I think the closest we've had to getting it right was, I would argue, the last most effective foreign policy we had in this country. That was under Bush 41 and his immensely talented Secretary of State, James Baker. It was the right combination of principle and pragmatism and smart transaction. It was a four-year run, unfortunately, but I think there's some lessons there.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're short of time. I want to get our other guests back in. Jim Baker, incidentally, I believe, has said he is supportive of Mr. Tillerson as Secretary of State. But Shane Goldmacher, you're our political reporter on the program. Is Donald Trump taking a chance? It's my understanding that no Secretary of State nominee has ever been turned down by the Senate and that none has ever been withdrawn by a president. But is this one a push too far, given the concern, the Republican concern that we've already heard about?
I mean, it's definitely a risk, and it's one that they were aware of. They saw it bubbling up over the weekend, and some have suggested that this is a part of push to get ahead of it and get Republicans to line up behind him. You know, there's a couple of nominees that that the Trump folks have some concerns about in terms of how they're going to get through, including his Secretary of State and his Treasury Secretary, who was his finance director on the campaign. And so, yeah, this is definitely a risk. That said, it's less of a risk because Republicans control the entire process. They have a majority in the Senate, and there is no filibuster on cabinet appointments.
Rob Barnett, back to you. We began our program talking about Rick Perry, Secretary of Energy. I don't believe I asked you. Do you think he has any problem getting confirmed by the U.S. Senate?
Well, I think broadly it's going to come down to how Republicans choose to act. You've seen some, certainly some criticisms of Rex Tillerson, but very few up or down signals on Rick Perry at this point or many others. So they're going to have to pick their battles carefully. And my sense is that, Rick Perry is in some sense a non-controversial choice for the Department of Energy. We'll probably see some good laughter about his oops moment, but other than that, don't expect a whole lot of political maneuvering around him.
Okay, a lot of battles to come, and as you indicated, I'm sure they will be carefully selected. We will see who wins, who loses as time goes on. Rob Barnett again with Bloomberg Intelligence, Shane Goldmarker with Politico, Richard Cohn at the University of North Carolina, Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Great to have you all, and we look forward to the next time. Thanks so much for being with us. A glimmer of hope for thousands of lives in Aleppo. In a moment on To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Alna here with today's talking point. Syrian forces were poised for a final sweep of eastern Aleppo, provoking urgent appeals from the United Nations, from world leaders and aid agencies. Now, Syrian rebels say that an agreement has been reached with Russia for a ceasefire to allow evacuations. Liz Sly joins us. She's bureau chief at the Washington Post in Beirut. Thanks, as always, for being with us, Liz.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
This sounds disturbingly familiar. Is this one for real?
This, I think, is the end of Aleppo. The rebels now control such a tiny pocket of territory. There's no way they can hold out against the government advance. It could be a matter of days. It could be a matter of hours. But they're pretty much done for in eastern Aleppo.
The United Nations has reported that 82 civilians were just killed on the spot in their homes by soldiers of the Assad government and allied Shiite militias. Is that typical of what you're hearing?
Yes. I mean, this is the big fear. You've got the end game now in Aleppo. It's over for the rebels. But how does it end? Does it end with a huge bloodbath? Or does it end with some kind of orderly evacuation? Or does it end with some kind of amnesty or peace deal? We're not going to get a peace deal. We've had 5 years of this war. We're nowhere near a peace deal. The best hope that remains now is for the people who are trapped there. There are tens of thousands of them, but we don't know how many tens of thousands. The best opportunity, the best hope is for them to be evacuated to some like rebel-held other area of the country, and that's what the deal envisages. Of course, if they're not evacuated, and there's a lot of speculation that this, or a lot of skepticism, I should say, I'm sorry, that this deal won't go through, they will be extremely vulnerable to the advancing government forces, who are going to be very vengeful and brutal when they take the areas over. We've seen it before in other places. This is the biggest place they've taken over, the most important place. But yes, the UN said it had these reports of the 82 civilians who were killed in their homes by the advancing government troops. And most of the people left trapped in Aleppo now have in one way or another been associated with opposition to Assad's rule. So they're all very scared.
People seem to be struggling for a language to describe what's going on. We have the UN humanitarian spokesman saying there's a complete meltdown of humanity.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure that that is something new to say about Syria. I think we've seen a meltdown of humanity in Syria for many, many years now, and the UN actually struggles to come up with language to describe it, as you said. We are now watching as troops from a victorious army march into a city or march into the neighborhoods of a city that had held demonstrations against the government and then taken control of their neighborhoods by force. Those government troops are bent on revenge. They are under no pressure whatsoever to abide by any of the rules by rules of war or international laws that govern behavior in a wartime situation, and anything could happen to them. And there's no journalists there, there's no independent press there, and nobody's doing anything about it.
A joint statement today was issued by U.S. Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, Republicans, of course, both. It says this: Aleppo will echo through history like Srebrenica and Rwanda as a testament to our moral failure and everlasting shame. This deal today seems to be made, by the Russians, by the rebels, and by the Assad regime. I don't hear the United States mentioned at all. Has it played any role?
Yes, it looks like the United States has not played any role in this deal. We've talked to U.S. officials. We've talked to Western diplomats from European countries who are kind of allied with the rebels. They have not been a part of this negotiation. It's been something between Russia and Turkey, who have their own little thing going on right now over Syria, because Turkey's taken over a little corner in the north, and Russia is backing the regime and controls the skies over Syria. They're sort of working with each other at the moment to sort of divvy up territory and fields of influence in Syria. They are the ones who've negotiated this deal. The United States has not been a part of it. The U.S. officials we talked to are extremely skeptical it will work, because they say Russia has committed to many other deals promising some kind of humanitarian way out for trapped people, and it hasn't abided by any of those deals in the past. Why should it now? This is a situation where the United States just is not really a player at all and has no influence.
You said earlier that this is the end of Aleppo, in the sense that there's no more rebellion left. There's simply no way that they can prevail. Does this mean that the Assad regime has won the civil war?
Well, actually, I think the Assad regime won the civil war a while ago when the Russians intervened. When the Russians intervened and the Americans said, go ahead, if you can solve it, you're welcome. That was a kind of green light, if you like, to Russia to crush the rebellion. And that's what we've seen happening. It has become a military inevitability that the rebels will fail anywhere they are confronted by the combined might of the Syrian army, which I have to say is not that strong. Might is probably the wrong word. They're pretty weak, which is why they needed the Russians in the first place. But they've got Russian air support now, and the rebels do not have anything like the firepower or numbers to confront those combined forces. So yes, the demise of the rebels has been on the cards for quite some time. But what you do have is still an extremely unstable country. The rebels do hold large areas of territory. None of them are as strategically significant as Aleppo is. But it's not going to be a war that ends anytime soon. And you've also got the Islamic State in control of a whole big area of the country. You've got Turkey now occupying a small part of it. You've got Iranian advisors and Iranian-backed militias on the ground, and it's still an incredibly messy situation that isn't going to go away.
The Islamic State apparently has just retaken Palmyra, which is symbolically, at least, a very important city.
Yes, and while we were all looking at Aleppo and wondering what would happen to the civilians in Aleppo and how much the government would take revenge against them, the Islamic State crept up and snatched Palmyra from under the noses of the regime and the Russians. And some quite extraordinary footage today showed the Islamic State in possession of quite a nice Russian base and quite a lot of Russian weaponry. This is like 2014 Redux, when they took over the Iraqi army bases and got all the American weaponry. So the fact that the regime has been so focused on getting the city of Aleppo back from the rebels against Assad's regime has, in a way, perhaps opened the door to the Islamic State to stage a comeback. And nobody thought the Islamic State was capable of a comeback at all.
When you say that the U.S. has had no influence in this current situation, and apparently has had no influence for some period of time, what does that mean for American influence in the rest of the Middle East?
Well, I think for a long time under the Obama administration, we've seen a significant waning of influence of the United States in the Middle East. America has always been sort of the regional superpower in the Middle East, and Obama said he wanted that to end. He articulated that. He did not believe the United States should be getting involved in something that in Syria, he called it someone else's civil war. It's nothing to do with us. We should try and ameliorate the situation, but not actually influence it or get too deeply involved. And American influence has waned massively in these past 5 to 8 years of the Obama administration. And one of the outcomes of that has been a flare-up of a lot of regional wars that possibly could have been tamped down, or perhaps not. It's really hard to say what would have happened if the Americans had done a bit more. But whatever, we're now in a situation where the Middle East is so like on fire, and so many wars are raging that it's really impossible to see anybody doing anything to stop them at this point.
Isn't that the argument, though, that's used in defense of the Obama administration, maybe we didn't take any action, but there wasn't any action we could have taken that would have made anything better?
I think it's impossible to say ever whether anything could have been any different or not. You've got huge forces building in the Middle East, 40 years of dictatorship in many countries, even more than that in some, people getting frustrated, nobody taking the reins to control things in any direction. It's really hard to say what would have happened. But I do believe that slightly tougher diplomacy at the very beginning of this, not military action, diplomacy before everything got militarily out of control, might have made people think twice, because the Americans are a very powerful military power and people don't want to cross the Americans. But now it's too late. There are military conflicts everywhere, and they can only be solved with military means at this point, I think.
We just have a couple of seconds left. But is it possible that ISIS is, in fact, useful to Assad, that there are reports that he allowed them to take Palmyra? You said that they just took it out from under his nose.
Well, there was one argument that you could say that the Syrian regime needs to make a case to the new administration of Donald Trump that it needs American support. It should be a partner against the Islamic State with America. And for that, perhaps you need to have a raging battlefront with ISIS and show that they're still a threat. At the moment, most of the front lines with ISIS are in the Kurdish areas, and the US is advising and the Kurds there and is on those front lines. But another argument that's all over the regime commentaries and everything else is that the U.S. enabled ISIS to take over Palmyra in order to screw with the Syrian regime. I don't believe that one either.
Liz Sly, really very interesting commentary. Thank you so much, Beirut Bureau Chief at The Washington Post. This is To The Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.